Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
Agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals,
hooligans. The government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government.
Welcome to the Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Cleveland area attorney and defender of freedom, Jay Carson.
Hey, good afternoon, Mike.
Yeah, that's right. We're doing this on a Friday afternoon after he's a long time off. I think it's been a month now since you and I have done the show. So I'm looking forward to getting at it.
I've been feeling like a neglected grandchild, Mike. It's good to have you back.
It's good to be back in the United States. I'm sure most listeners would know I've been for the last 3 weeks in Italy and then France, where my wife and I are planning on, we think we might be moving sometime in 2024, depending on how various things work out or don't, that sort of thing. So yeah, we learned a lot. It was definitely a working trip. I'm kind of still recovering from the jet lag that combined with a thunderstorm all last night. And one of our dogs, who was deathly afraid of them, being up and down on the bed looking for some sort of comfort, has me. I'm kind of running on fumes here, but I think I have more than enough adrenaline at the prospect of getting to do the show again with you to get me through until I collapse, like sort of like the Blues Brothers car at the end of the movie there. So we'll see how I could do. But anyway, so also I wanted to remember to let listeners know that we're hoping to do our next supporter choice, supporter participation episode. We've done a couple of those already. We're hoping we'll be able to do that maybe August 11th or 12th, somewhere in through there. We're going to try to do it on an afternoon if we can arrange our schedules, so that way folks who aren't in Eastern time and couldn't make the last two 9 a.m. Eastern things, they'll have another option there. So that's coming up in a few weeks. And as you probably know, that's one of those bonuses we offer to our Patreon supporters at a $10 a month or higher level. If you want to check that out, you know, patreon.com/politicsguys, or we always have the link in the show notes there. So anyway, all right, with that, we've got a lot to talk about. New Donald Trump charges. Yes, there are more. The Hunter Biden plea deal, Biden's asylum policy being kicked by the courts, at least for now. All kinds of stuff about the heat and what the government's going to do about it. Anything. UFOs, if the truth is out there. Harvard's legacy admitted. I don't know what we're going to get to, but we're going to get to a bunch. But before we do that, Jay, on a brief note, I'm sure, like a lot of listeners, you saw that really uncomfortable moment for Mitch McConnell when he was in front of the cameras there and froze. And clearly there may be some issues. He suffered some falls and had a concussion this year and been out of commission. And I've been, I think, clear for a long time that I think in many ways, Mitch McConnell is a worse person than Donald Trump, because Mitch McConnell knows full well what he's doing. And I believe that Mitch McConnell cares for nothing more than the preservation and enhancement of Republican power by almost any means necessary. That aside, just as a human being, seeing another human under those horrible, just mortifying circumstances, my heart went out to Mitch McConnell, and I wouldn't wish that on anyone, well, maybe Vladimir Putin aside, and I certainly hope that he recovers to the extent that he can, depending on what's going on. So I just wanted to put that out there.
No, that's true. That's awfully big of you, Mike.
Well, you know, I am an awfully big sort of person, but no, I mean, I think it's important. It's so easy, right, to demonize our political opponents and make them almost subhuman in some way and think of them in that way. But there is that common humanity we share. And when you see someone in a position like that, I would hope that at least to some extent, our hearts would go out to even our most implacable political opponents. So I hope you're feeling better, Mitch. All right. So on Thursday, prosecutors in the Mar-a-Lago documents case updated their indictment, alleging that Donald Trump asked the staffer to delete surveillance camera footage in an attempt to obstruct that investigation into his unauthorized possession of classified documents. And in addition, prosecutors added a third defendant, Mar-a-Lago property manager Carlos D. Oliveira, who they allege conspired with Trump and Trump's valet, Walt Nauta, in the effort to conceal camera footage from federal investigators looking into the classified documents case. Now, according to Michael Cohen, Trump's former fixer guy, right, Donald Trump likes to do business sort of like a mob boss, right? He uses code and works through cutouts and never actually says clear things like delete that surveillance footage, you know. So, for instance, in this particular case, it's alleged that D. Oliveira told another Mar-a-Lago employee to delete the footage on the server because the boss wanted it done. Now, it's possible that the inclusion of now a third defendant could further delay the trial, which Judge Eileen Cannon has scheduled to begin in May. That's a lot later than prosecutors wanted. They wanted it to happen starting in December, but it's also sooner than Trump's attorneys wanted because they've contended that Trump can't really get a fair trial before the 2024 presidential election. And of course, all this is separate from the indictment that's expected to come out of Special Counsel Jack Smith's investigation into Trump's attempts to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. And on that, it was Thursday, on the Truth Social, Trump wrote, "My attorneys had a productive meeting with the DOJ this morning, explaining in detail that I did nothing wrong, was advised by many lawyers, and that an indictment of me would only further destroy our country." Further destroy. Okay, anyway, no indication of notice was given during the meeting. Do not trust the fake news on anything. So, Jay, I got to say, before I get your take on this, I think it's at this point getting kind of difficult to keep track of all the charges and pending indictments against Trump. But as far as I have it, if I'm following along correctly, and I think I am, in addition to this and the other indictment from Smith that we're expecting to come out soon, there's the New York case involving those hush money payments to Stormy Daniels. The trial there is set to begin on March 25th of next year. And there's also the state of Georgia investigation into Trump's efforts to reverse the result in that state in 2020. And it's expected that charges in that investigation may end up coming sometime in August. And for now, I think that gets us up to date on Donald Trump's legal jeopardy. So I'll let you jump in wherever you want on that.
Well, I think there's also, although this ship may have sailed, the criminal tax fraud in New York.
Right now, I think, yeah, the tax fraud, I think, involves the hush money payments because that was that weird legal theory, right, where it was somehow a felony.
No. The not reporting the taxes correctly on the Trump property stuff.
Okay, was that a separate thing? Yeah, like I said, it's hard to keep track this point. So.
Yeah.
His lawyers are, well, not that Donald Trump is famous, of course, for not paying people, but assuming Donald Trump does pay his attorneys, they're certainly going to be well paid by the end of this. So, but on that specific thing that I focused on in the open, what do you make of, this indictment or this updated, I forget the word, indictment and adding another defendant? And does this really materially change things in any significant way as far as you can tell at this point?
I think this does to some extent, and the reason is the obstruction of justice piece strikes me as one. There's a little bit of a, and again, we don't know this is true, right? Everybody's presumed to be innocent at this point. These are just allegations, but if they are true. What it shows is an indicia of, what Trump understood to be doing was illegal, right?
Right. Okay.
You don't obstruct justice if you think your conduct is completely legal. The other piece of it is
you wouldn't say like I did nothing wrong but destroy the tape.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Good point. Yeah, it's a good point. Yeah.
So, you know, I think that's and I think people get the idea of, look, you can make, and I don't want to say it's a separation of powers argument, because it really isn't, right? About the, you know, whether Trump could classify them, or he could, you know, think about or declassifying the documents or whatever. But I think there's still a, and this isn't so much the legal argument, but the political argument of people who could say, yeah, look, he's the president, and yeah, he shouldn't have kept it afterwards, but you know, he's still legit, and you know, maybe the law technically doesn't say he can just declassify it by just snapping his fingers, but you know, but this is something different. And I think you don't get that benefit of the doubt, and you don't have that argument of, hey, I'm the president, I can declassify stuff. Even though I don't think that's a great argument, but it's much harder to be, why did you erase the tapes?
Right. And you add that with him saying, after he was no longer president, saying to someone allegedly tape that, hey, it's classified, but I kept it anyway. It. Yeah. You know, yeah. So that's yeah.
Yeah. So I do think this is different. And it goes again, not to, again, this strikes me as more, there's two classes in the law. There's what's called, malum in se and malum prohibitum.
Ooh,
right.
Latin.
The in se, of course, is it's something that is bad and evil in and of itself. The other is just kind of prohibited, and the keeping the documents strikes me as, well, look, this is just a rule, and sure, it's a good rule, but you could also have a rule that would say former presidents can't keep documents, right? There's nothing inherently immoral, right, in saying a former president could still have access to classified documents. But there is something that it strikes people, I think, is inherently immoral in the, we're going to, you know, destroy or falsify evidence.
Yeah.
And I think that's why where it sort of hits home a little bit. And again, it sort of it indicates an attempt to cover up, as opposed to, you know, again, what his defense was before, sort of a good faith belief that he's allowed to access those documents. I think that these are all bad facts for Trump. I think it gets more difficult for folks who are on the fence to support him through this. I mean, again, you can, and let me be clear. I've gone on the record saying I think the New York case is nonsense. That shouldn't have been brought. I think the Georgia case is reaching. The Jack Smith remains to be seen. I am not convinced that I don't think that I'm not crazy about the Jack Smith case, but this one, the January 6th Jack Smith, but this.
Well, I mean, barring pointing out that neither of us have seen, there haven't been indictments yet, and so, but your presumption based on what publicly available information is that it's going to be a reach,
right? Knowing that, yeah, what Trump said at speeches and rallies. Was it intemperate? Was it dumb? Was it inciting people to insurrection? I don't think it reaches that level. So,
but you know, it seems to me that
obstruction of justice is obstruction of justice, and this certainly does tick the boxes for that that offense.
It seems to me that it doesn't really matter for the Republican primary. I mean, if we take a look at the polling, and DeSantis seems to be cratering, right? He's making all kind of changes to his campaign, and it just things are going poorly. And Donald Trump is so far ahead of the rest of the field at this point. I find it not inconceivable, but I find it unlikely that a man who many Republican voters see as the incumbent president still won't end up almost cruising to renomination. And that trial is going to be in May. And that's going to be probably after the Republican primary is pretty much decided, even though it's going to be before the convention in July. Right. But I don't see this hurting him at all in that. Now, I think your point is about the undecided kind of voters that, maybe that makes him less electable in the general, But most of that's baked in too. But then again, it doesn't take a whole lot of votes either way to change the outcome in some of these states. You know, just ask Hillary Clinton, right?
Yeah. So I am still going to be a little bit I don't know what the word is. I don't want to say disagreeable. It's not disagreeable.
Sometimes
it's harder when I do the shows. Sometimes I'm better doing the shows Friday, and sometimes I'm not. Contrarian, perhaps.
There you go. Right? Okay.
That's the word I was looking for. In that, yes, Trump leads the polls, leads them by a lot, as he would say. But nobody's voted yet. So, and there is a long time until people vote. So I'm still don't know that lead holds up. And you can look at historically other folks who were front runners who had, you know, significant leads at this point in time and then fell apart.
Sure. Absolutely.
And fell apart with much less baggage than Trump. Now again, the idea with Trump is, of course, that the people who are for him have already factored that in that baggage. But there's always so much more. And I do think if, you know, whether it's DeSantis or whether it's someone else who can say, listen, I can give you the Trump policies, but without the unnecessary drama.
But it seems to, it reminds me of kind of like a Scott Walker before that, or after that, around that time, Jeb Bush sort of thing, where, hey, no matter how much the establishment might like somebody, right, it's great to do well with them, but in the end, if you're not an effective campaigner, if you can't reach the people, then it's just not going to happen for you, right? And yeah. I think clearly it's Trump, then DeSantis distantly away, and then just a bunch of, you know, I don't know, probably more than seven dwarves, but whatever. I mean, nobody who's even popped up anywhere. So even though I will agree with you that it's far too early to, you know, to give Trump the title, right, that, boy, it would take an awful lot from DeSantis or anyone else to knock him off.
And I would also add to that analysis. I mean, you're correct there in that the historical precedents I'm looking at, right, did not involve a former president running again.
Right. That changes things a lot, potentially.
I mean, it's not, you know, again, this is almost a situation of like an incumbent.
Yeah.
Sort of running for a primary.
Yeah. And like I said, I was not joking in saying that for an awful lot of Republican voters, they see Donald Trump as the rightly elected president in 2020. And so he isn't affecting their minds, the incumbent president.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you think there's any possibility of any sort of a pre-trial deal here, or does this just get fought off to the bitter end?
Oh! You mean in the actual
we'll
case?
Talk, yeah,
no, I think it gets fought out to the end.
Yeah, I don't see any advantage to Trump in making any sort of a deal either. But maybe
because Trump actually sees this as an advantage.
Yeah,
and to some extent, it is to say, look how they're persecuting me.
Well, you know, the reason I brought this up, of course, is I have pretrial deals on my mind lately, right? Which maybe is a good segue into our the next thing we want to talk about, if you want to lead us into.
So, our next story is under the headline of, wow, that didn't go as planned. the Hunter Biden plea deal imploded is the word I've seen a lot of lately. On Thursday, after Judge Noriega indicated that she didn't believe that the deal had been fleshed out yet, she was not ready to rule on it. Biden ended up entering a not guilty plea. There were fireworks at the courthouse as the prosecution indicated that they might, in fact, seek further charges against Biden, despite Hunter Biden, let me clarify, despite the plea deal. And Hunter Biden's lawyers said that emphatically that was not the deal. And that if that's what the government was saying, they could just rip up the plea deal, which is seems to more or less have been what happened. Now, the way these things work, right, you can always come back and come up with another plea deal. But this is certainly not a good. Let's put it this way. Again, this is not how anyone was expecting this to go. And it's certainly not a good turn of events for Hunter Biden. And we can talk about whether maybe or maybe not it's a good turn of events for Joe Biden. What are your thoughts, Mike?
I guess I'm thinking about this in two ways. Number one, I looked at sort of the deal itself and what the judge said. And on that, I found myself sort of agreeing with her. It seemed to be, if you go into a situation, right, where Hunter Biden did, and the judge says, well, do you agree to plead guilty, understanding that additional charges can be filed against you? And you say, huh? No,
what?
I mean, that's yeah. That someone
yeah,
did
no,
either.
That's what you have to do at that point. Yeah. You have to say, yeah.
And so when he didn't say that, my understanding is that everyone scrambled and said, well, let's put something together really quick. And they did that. And not surprisingly, the judge said, well, wait a second. So you're saying that somehow I'm supposed to be in charge of figuring out if Biden violates the terms. And then if he does, right, I will somehow bring these charges back as opposed
And that's another piece of this deal, which is entirely unusual.
Yeah.
Is that it sort of turned it over to the judge to supervise his adherence to the plea deal rather than to the prosecution, which again is odd. And the judge said, wait a second, I'm not sure I can have the constitutional authority to do this.
Which is what I think a prudent judge should do, especially in such a high profile case. If you're not sure, just say, hold on a minute here. This doesn't seem right to me. And it seemed a little funky to me, too. So there's that. Right. But I feel like what happened has been mischaracterized by a lot of people. Like, for instance, it seems to me that the Republican talking point is that this was a sweetheart deal that fell apart. Virginia Fox, who's a Republican on the House Oversight Committee, said the development that the sweetheart deal turned sour is welcome news to every American. It collapsed under the weight of its own blatant corruption. I'm like, well, if you want to argue it collapsed under the weight of anything, maybe blatant incompetence, perhaps you could say, okay, it does not seem to be a well-structured deal, but what Fox and other Republicans have said, prominent Republicans have said, seems to me to be going past what we actually know to be the case and engaging in some pretty significant, and I would argue in some instances, unfounded speculation.
Yeah, so I would tend to agree, yeah, because I read it differently as to what happened. And again, if you look just at the facts that we absolutely know for sure, right, what happened in court, the judge absolutely did the right thing, saying, look, this isn't, you know, one, you're asking me to approve a deal. It doesn't sound like you actually have a deal.
Right. That's a problem. Yeah.
You know, so that's the biggest piece of it right there. Second of all, the deal you are sort of asking me to approve requires me to do something that I'm not sure I can constitutionally do. So I need to check on that. And third, this is a big public piece with some moving parts, and it is necessary to get this right. The other thing that I didn't mention, which is also kind of a weird, curious thing, is the call to the clerk's office. I don't know if you followed any of this stuff.
No, go to, please.
So the judge has also put on an order asking Hunter Biden's lawyers to show cause why they should not be held in contempt for an alleged conversation with a member of the clerk's staff, where a person from Lanham Watkins, the Hunter Biden's law firm, called the clerk's office and said there was that something was filed inappropriately, that it hadn't been appropriately redacted. And, you know, could the clerk's office strike that or pull it off the docket? Now, this is where it gets interesting, because there are two different stories. The clerk employee at this point, is what we're led to believe, said that the person who called them said they were calling from the prosecution, or from an amicus, a conservative group that filed a brief. The person at Lanham Watkins denies that. So the court is looking at that, but that's, and then what happened was the entire amicus brief was pulled from the record, which had this, stuff, which was public anyway, but setting that aside, it's weird. And it's, there's weirdness and there's look, stuff happens in the miscommunication with clerk's office and so forth. But this is extra weirdness to an extra weird case to begin with.
Setting
that aside, right? Because again, we don't know. The judge will issue a ruling on that at some point, and then we'll know. But
I guess you and I haven't had a chance to talk about really so much the charges and what was agreed to more or less, or not clearly less than Biden would have liked. But okay, so. Yeah. There are two basic things, right? Unlawful possession of a firearm because he was a drug user, and there's a federal law against that. Now, based on my understanding, it's not crazy to have an agreement with a pretrial diversion program, which is part of the deal, when the defendant doesn't have a prior criminal record. In fact, I think you can make the argument that the fact that this was Joe Biden's kid made it more likely that he'd be charged with this in the first place. And then the second part of it is failure to pay taxes, right? Two misdemeanor counts he was supposed to plead guilty to. Now, often in these failure to pay taxes cases, charges aren't even brought. Now, when they are, my understanding is they're more likely to be felony charges if you're going to bother to bring them in the first place.
Right. Because most people, exactly.
So this feels,
it's a misdemeanor thing. It's just,
This feels like a compromise. And so I think not only is this not a sweetheart deal, but you can make a reasonably strong argument that he was actually treated more harshly by prosecutors because the microscope was on him and because he was Joe Biden's kid, whereas just some random rich connected guy who wasn't related to the president of the United States probably wouldn't have had any charges filed against him at all.
Well, I suppose you can make that argument. The two IRS whistleblowers who have testified under oath would tend to disagree. I think the bigger issue on the tax thing, the gun thing, I agree with you on. The tax thing, I think the bigger issue is, did the IRS slow walk all of the tax stuff, Justice Department, slow walk all of that so that the statute of limitations had run on the more serious tax offenses. And those are questions that they're looking at. So to me, that's, if you want to say the corruption sweetheart, that's where it is.
Let me say on that, Jay,
on the gun thing, that is sort of small potatoes. So
on the tax thing, I would say there are maybe two elements of this. If federal if folks in the administration did this because they thought it would somehow curry favor, or they were concerned about repercussions if they were too aggressive, that's one thing. It's something else and far more serious if there were people from inside the inner circle of the Biden administration who reached out and made comments, threats, however you want to, warnings, if you will. That's a whole different level. Now, I know there's a House committee that's looking at, right, the Biden family, crime family committee or whatever, looking into all of this stuff. And as far as I can tell so far, there's no indication that there's any direct involvement from the White House. But I certainly could understand if I'm some mid-level government employee and I know that the president's kid is potentially up on charges, I could see where if I were concerned about my job and maybe didn't have the sterling integrity that, of course, I possess, where I might say, gee, I don't know, maybe I should go a little slower on this, even if no one said anything to me. So this strikes me go ahead.
Their testimony to some extent is that they wanted to pursue other things. Hey, can we go interview, conduct this interview, when they were told no? Hey, can we do follow up with this witness?
Right.
No. And that sort of thing. And that's the question that, again, that's what they've testified to. And that's what the hearings are looking at. And the question then also goes to U.S. Attorney Weiss, the U.S. Attorney for Delaware, who is, the guy bringing the charges, essentially, whether he had free rein or not. You have witnesses who said that he said that, decisions were being made above his head. Now, he has been called to testify before Congress, and he is not at this point, which gets me to, if I'm really being sinister, Mike,
go for it.
The government's insistence that, oh, additional charges may still be brought. That essentially helps get Weiss off the hook because he can then say, well, the investigation's ongoing. I can't testify. Whereas if this does conclude the investigation and everything is done, wrapped up with a bow and it's all over, then there's no reason that Weiss couldn't testify.
Well, to kind of be contrary into that, when it comes to these sort of massive plots and organized things, I tend to think
a massive plot.
Well, you're right. It's a medium plot. Right. But I tend to go with the simplest explanation, kind of human nature. And so if you're the prosecutor, maybe you just say or imply something like that to give yourself coverage. Well, it's out of my hands. There are people upstairs. Tell them. And maybe they are, maybe they aren't. Right. And this all, I hate this conspiracy.
That's fine. But the question is, did he say it or didn't he say
it? Yeah. Right. And this was he being truthful and saying, no,
that's a question worth asking. Yeah. The other piece that strikes me is just weird about this is the law firm that's representing Hunter Biden. They are, there are no slouches, right? This is one of the premier law firms in the country. And they tend to specialize in a lot of, Democratic causes. And with a very important client. And it's sort of inconceivable to me that they would go to court, show up at the morning of the hearing, if they did not have actual real assurances that this would end all the charges against their client.
Yeah, that seems really weird.
I mean, that's the first question if I'm the client, right? And a client who has an important dad. Would ask is, if I plead to this, is this mean it's all over? I can't imagine them proceeding as far as they had if the government had not actually made those assurances to them. That to me is sort of, and again, this wasn't, this plea deal wasn't just kind of thrown together over a cup of coffee. I mean, these were sort of intense negotiations over a period of months between the United States Justice Department and one of the country's highest powered law firms. It's unbelievable that sort of detail just kind of slips through the cracks.
And which, it's not right. Which, this is again, this
I'm
still.
I'm not trying to be conspiratorial.
No, this is different. Point out that I think if you look at any prosecution of a powerful and connected person under this kind of a microscope, you would find all sorts of weird stuff. But you're right. There's a distinction between like the weird clerk thing that you're talking about, which is kind of maybe a peripheral sort of thing, as opposed to failing to nail down the key element in
the essential material piece.
And so something
it's like in a civil settlement agreement saying, okay, if I settle this, if I pay you this, then that ends our lawsuit. Yes. Except I might sue you again.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah,
it's kind of a fundamental piece is you're releasing all the claims.
Yeah. There's no way the two options are either, like you said, that these highly trained, incredibly intelligent people who knew they were under a microscope either were somehow
getting paid thousands of dollars an hour.
Yeah. Were somehow inexplicably incompetent. Or someone's not telling the whole truth.
Yes.
And I know where my money is, right? So, but yeah. So to me, though, you know, kind of weird. The irony of this is what is Hunter Biden accused and admitted to doing? Well, having a gun and screwing over the IRS. You would think Republicans would love that. I mean, my God, that's practically your
I am a little sympathetic to him on the gun charge. I think that's kind of not that big a deal.
Yeah. So on this, do you think that I asked a settlement question before? Obviously, I think it's very different. Do you think that they will be able to come up with some sort of a settlement here that, you know, after they kind of work over it again, what you're thinking?
Let's watch to see what happens with the Weiss subpoena and whether he will testify. And I think you may start getting the answer there if I'm right. Right. I mean, I could be wrong and I could just be completely conspiratorial. I haven't been able to talk to you for like 3 weeks. So my mind kind of wanders into the fever swamps of the
there
right.
There you go.
without you bringing me back, but no, I think there's a concern there And the other, okay, the other thing, this is going back to not conspiracy theories, but everyone knew, of course, when this deal was announced, if you're President Biden, if you are Democratic politicians, if you are Team Hunter, that this deal would be heavily criticized no matter what it did, right? If the deal was Hunter is going to spend 5 years in jail, Republicans would have criticized it as a sweetheart deal, right? I mean, that's the political fact. But despite all this, and despite the getting hammered on the this is a sweetheart deal, this is a sweetheart deal, the government, and again, the government being accused of corruption, right? The prosecution being accused of corruption and giving him, no one ever said, no, it's not a sweetheart deal because we can still prosecute him on these other things. And to me, that's what sort of strikes me as why wouldn't you have said that?
That would be a poor thing to point out. Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of questions here for sure. And to me, this is larger than Hunter Biden. I think this just kind of puts really magnifies the extent to which, at least I believe, we really have sort of a two-tier justice system. If you are a powerful and connected person, things work differently from you. If you were just some, like if I decided to take drugs and get a gun and not pay my taxes, things would be different for me. I would certainly consult you before I get any of those. Not prior to that, because that would involve you in a criminal conspiracy.
If you paid hush money to a porn star mistress.
So yeah, things would be a little different for me. But anyway, how about we stick with Joe Biden, but this time in actual policy stuff, because we'll stay still with the judicial stuff, because President Biden's asylum policy was recently struck down, wasn't it?
Yeah. So on Tuesday, a federal judge blocked Joe Biden's asylum plan. Issued an injunction, essentially putting the ruling on hold for 14 days for possible appeal. But Judge John Tiger of California's Northern District, who'd actually ruled against a similar Trump administration policy. I said that, look, this looks pretty much the same as the Trump policy. It has to do with when migrants can be essentially taken out, removed from the country, or whether it's Friday afternoon.
It can be rough. But
Civil Liberties Union sued that the asylum rule bars migrants who's passed through another country from seeking asylum in the U.S., which is new. So and similar to the Trump rule that was sort of similar to the
it's weird.
Stay in Mexico.
It's weird to me, Jay, because this seems to be an example of a policy that's effective, but clearly illegal, as far as I could tell. What I mean is okay. So the policy, if you're an asylum seeker and you've crossed through another country on your way to the border, only the southern border, I think we're not having a whole lot of problems with the Canadian thing, unless you've previously applied for and been denied asylum somewhere else, or you're able to get the CBP-1 app on your phone and schedule an appointment at a port of entry, then you are barred from seeking asylum. And now that's worked, right? Something like under the new rules, like almost 90% of the people applying for asylum have been ruled ineligible. And this is a big change from like pre.
Well, they've been to be clear, they've been ineligible to apply for asylum.
Right. They've been, and if you can't, you can't get it.
Not simply they've applied for asylum and not got it.
Exactly, which is even easier, right? Which that was after Title 42, which was basically doing the same sort of thing, but then the public health emergency ends. And so here's the weird thing. So it's been successful, right? The rates of even allowing people to apply way down. So from a policy perspective, at least if you want to keep people, that many people from applying, from overloading the system, it's worked. But the problem here is I actually did something that apparently the Biden administration decided not to do.
You looked at the statute.
Ah, damn it. What was I thinking? let me read this, the relevant portion. Any alien who is physically present in the United States or who arrives in the United States whether or not at a designated port of arrival and including an alien who's brought to the United States after having been interdicted in international United States waters, irrespective of such alien status, may apply for asylum. Now, I don't know, Jay, that's pretty clear to me. It doesn't say you have to have the app. It doesn't say you have to do it through a regular port of entry.
Mike, clearly that Biden, this is one of those cases where you ought to defer to the asylum experts who interpret these policies and interpret that statute to mean that you have to have the app and apply from a different country first. That's obviously a plain, easy interpretation that, again, the experts could make.
I mean, I literally, because, you know, I expected to need to take a lot of time on this one. and like I said, I read the statute and I was like, well, duh. The president doesn't get to write the asylum laws. And what they're doing here is creating procedures, creating regulations that effectively do rewrite the law. And hey, you know, that the code goes on to basically say, if you've suffered persecution or you have a fear of it because of a race, religion, nationality, politics, or part of a group you're in, you get to apply if you're here. That's just like, period. If Congress wants to change that, they can do that. But the president, I don't care if it's Trump, I don't care if it's Biden, they don't get to do that for me. This is an easy one. The judge was right. I don't know what the Ninth Circuit's going to do, because obviously the administration is going to appeal.
I think you can still make the argument of sort of for a remain in Mexico type thing of you can apply, but you don't have automatic access.
In fact, to
move freely around the country. But I don't think you can bar the application.
Yeah, no, that's a good point, because part of the asylum law does say has an exception about international agreements, and some kind of a remain in Mexico policy would presumably relate to that, or could relate to that in some way. But like I said, this just seems to me to be an easy one. And I understand why the Biden administration did it, but I don't know. This one's, like I said, this just seems to me, like I said, to be effective. You want to keep people out, but pretty clearly the president, the administration going well beyond what they can legally do.
Well, I'd also argue even on the effectiveness, right? Because it's a matter of, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how many people are actually being moved and caught, and maybe all this does is prevents the application, but it doesn't prevent the illegal immigration.
Yeah, as far as I could tell, now I'd have to double check on this. I wouldn't want to just go off the cuff, but just the numbers of encounters are way down as well. And I think that wouldn't be surprising, because if the word comes out that, hey, you're not even going to get an application or not even get an interview for asylum, then that might make people less likely to kind of try. But it might
make them less likely to just show up and turn themselves into Border Patrol and say, hi, I'd like to apply for asylum.
Yeah. But as far as I know, that's not what's been happening. But in any case, this is basically a continuation of the Trump era Title 42 light, just with a different
reason behind it. Yeah.
Because Title 42 was perfectly reasonable when we had a public health emergency. It wasn't. And so they need to do something. And pretty clearly, there's not the political will, the bipartisan agreement to make changes either to asylum law, which, you know, the Trump administration, at least early on, was interested in doing, or to beef up our capacity to deal with all the asylum seekers, which plenty of people, including myself on the left, would like to do, and also some libertarians as well. None of those things are going to happen any point in the immediate future, but just kind of making your own law to deal with it off the cuff is not okay.
Yeah.
There we go.
I think we agree on this one.
All right. Every once in a while. So, all right. Why don't we move on to something really different? I don't know how it is in Cleveland right now, but I'm betting it's hot. Yeah.
Yeah. It's sort of hot.
Yeah. Muggy. Generally muggy. Yeah. It was when I was in Italy and France, just ridiculous. The heat beating down. It's just in Rome, especially you know, of course, as people know, if you're in the Northern Hemisphere, I think it's pretty hot. We're setting heat records all over the place. July is on pace to be the hottest month ever recorded. And it's not like the government can do anything about the weather, But there are things.
Or can they?
Well, yeah, go ahead. I'm kidding. Okay. Yes, but with alien technology. Anyway, but there are things, right, that can you that government can potentially do. Number one, about longer term climate change, as well as in the shorter term, ways to help protect people from the heat, extreme weather that a lot of people are clearly and obviously experiencing. And for instance, on Thursday, President Biden announced a number of measures that his administration would take to help folks deal with the heat. He said, we want the American people to know help is here, and we're going to make it available to anyone who needs it. Now, one of those measures is that the Department of Labor has issued a heat hazard alert to remind employees of their legal obligation to protect workers from heat illness, heat injury in the workplace. That's going to be combined with increased inspections, enhanced enforcement by OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. In addition to that, Biden announced that the Forest Service would be awarding over $1 billion in grants to help communities plant trees. And that can actually make a big difference, especially in urban areas. There's been some research finding that if you put in a decent amount of tree coverage, that can lower core temperatures by more than 15 degrees Fahrenheit in some instances. Which
yes. Actually, that's something I've been preaching for years.
Well, I want to get to that because I know the trillion trees thing is a big Republican thing. But I should mention some other actions. More support.
I've never even heard of that, actually.
Oh, yeah. Well, we'll get into that. But anyway,
all right.
More support for expanding trees, water storage in Western states, which need it. Increased funding to the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration for improving weather forecasts to help improve preparedness, getting better forecasts for heat waves, other extreme events like that. So that's kind of the general stuff that President Biden outlined. Do you have any problems with that stuff?
Not particularly.
It seems like basic
stuff. I mean, again, I'm sure if I dig into the details, I could find something I didn't like. I would be remiss if I didn't note that our I think like four ARPA water slides at our new pool are now all broken. So again, that just you know, at my you know, question of always whether can the government really do anything competently and so forth. And again, our to cure COVID, to rescue the American economy, we did put in a bunch of water slides at our public pool. Anyway, it struck me again as that sort of doing double duty, helping with the heat wave and rescuing America. But no, I'm all for a lot of these interventions that are essentially low dough, non-transformative of the economy type thing of putting in more trees in urban areas that reduces the urban thermal island phenomenon you get. Painting rooftops white or other reflective things, that cuts down significantly on heat that's absorbed in urban areas. Generally I'm all for that sort of stuff. Because it strikes me that our ability to control rein in whatever you want to say climate change is always necessarily limited. Even if the United States stopped all carbon emissions tomorrow, China's still putting whatever it is, 14 new coal plants or whatever the number is a month. I think it's probably higher than that online. So I think we're better off. The money's better spent looking at these remediation efforts. And this is going to sound sort of silly, but to treat the symptom, as it were. As opposed to the disease, and again, I'm always, like I said, I'm not a climate denier by any means, but I'm skeptical of individual, findings that come out every now and again, particularly the ones that indicate the world's ending. So
if I understand your position on this more generally, it's that you believe that there is good evidence that humans have contributed in a significant way to climate change, but you believe that many of the reports on it are worst case scenario alarmist, and that you have perhaps, not perhaps, you have considerably more faith than I do in the ability of markets and technology to deal with these things before they reach any sort of a tipping point.
Yes.
Yeah. That's kind of what I thought. Yeah. And that's kind of where, that's kind of where,
or if, even if we reach a tipping point, I have better faith in markets to deal with these things than I do the government. And in either event, I think that, you know, typically the idea of, well, we just need to have the government control more of the economy. I don't know that helps the problem. So,
but yeah, I mentioned a trillion trees thing. In fact, I think what's a couple months ago, or maybe last month, I guess time's blurring for me. Speaker McCarthy mentioned the trillion trees thing. And now, you know, there's research, obviously pretty good research, saying that, yeah, that's certainly a good thing for capturing carbon and lowering temperatures and that sort of thing. A lot of us on the left feel like, well, it's just a way to kind of essentially ignore the greater problem, because number one, well, a trillion trees would require something like, I believe, the land mass of the continental U.S., and that there were things that we could do that are more effective, but that would require more sacrifices from deep-pocketed industries that aren't really interested in doing that sort of thing. And so I think President Biden, in fact, has said, you know, he thinks that this is just some sort of a feint from the right, and it doesn't really, you know, oh, we're dealing with it, we just need to plant a trillion trees. And well, I think that
left hate trees.
Well, no, our ability to pollute certainly is far greater than the efforts we have put in place to mitigate the effects of climate change. Even though I'll point out that the Biden administration has done more than any other administration on this, but even that, you know, that's often touted, right? The Inflation Reduction Act. I know you love that name.
Right, right.
The largest piece of climate legislation in U.S. history, but even that, $370 billion over 10 years, that's over 10 years thing is the important thing. That's not really a ton considering the scope of the problem. And again, I'm coming at this from
no trees.
Well, no, that trees are part of that. He mentioned
the trees in there. All right.
The Forest Service is awarding over $1 billion in grants for trees. So, yeah, you can plant a lot of trees for $1 billion, I would expect.
All right. Maybe not a trillion, but still a lot.
No, yeah. probably not a trillion. But I guess my point is that I come at this from a very different perspective. And I guess we agree that human-caused climate change is a real thing. I differ from you somewhat in that I think you believe that the reports are more alarmist and worst case than I believe. And then we differ a lot in I am less confident in the ability of future society, whatever it's 10, 20 years, to deal with a potential tipping point when you have things like currents changing, glaciers melting. There are certain things I have come to understand or believe that once they're gone, they will be so far beyond our ability to get back. And you are just, I think, almost crazily optimistic on that.
Well, that could be.
I hope you're right. I mean, that would be nice, but I, you know, we'll find. Has this season of record heat changed the way you feel about any of this stuff, or not really so much?
Not particularly. And I'll tell you why. Because again, I've said I accept that, you know, climate change is real, and we can you can say it's hotter than it has been before. When I start to get extra skeptical, right? Are these claims? There was someone saying, "Well, this is, you know, the hottest summer it's been in 125,000 years or so." And that strikes me as, well, do we really? One, we don't really have the records from 125,000 years ago, and I understand we can do things like with ice cores and so forth, and you can drill down and you can find and you can extrapolate information, right, from ice cores, fossil records, all that sort of stuff. But we, you know, when we're talking about tenths of degrees, and we're also talking about global temperatures, does that really tell us what's going on globally? I'm not always sure that it does. Secondly, I'm also skeptical, and not of the science, but of scientists. Look, there is I could point to, there was a piece recently on, this is all coming out of the you know, the various COVID cases and some of the scientists who wrote a journal article saying, no, there's no way this virus could have been man-made or could have escaped from a lab. There's email correspondence going back and forth between them saying, well, yeah, it really could be. But you know what? This is what we need to say right now. And we don't want their words, shit show, blaming the Chinese for this. So here's what we'll say. So I'm skeptical that, you know, I would put it in this phrase that all humans lie and all scientists are human. And the beauty of science, right? The thing that why science has been the driver of Western civilization is that it can get around that by saying, okay, then if you don't believe these guys, do the experiment yourself.
Right.
And that is sort of the way to truth, the way to get around the fact that all humans lie is, well, okay, maybe they do. But if you have a whole bunch of different people and they all try this and they all come up with the same results, then you know. And again, that's, I don't know. I'm skeptical of global temperatures and how we measure those. It's been unseasonably cool in Cleveland this year. This is like, you know, probably one of the first days it's been over 90, and it's the end of July. That's unusual. I'm not disagreeing that it's crazy hot other places.
I think, you know, there's distinction. My understanding of when they're talking about warmest ever recorded means ever recorded, not before recording. Yeah. Technology for temperature.
Well, no, but there have been some statements. Yeah, I heard just this morning of people saying.
Well, I think it depends because
in the hundreds of thousands of year, you know.
I think there's that filter effect. Like for instance, when you're hearing a lot of climate news reported through media of the right, I think they tend to pull out the craziest, most out there stuff and representative as being the view of the mainstream.
No, this was public. This was public radio. This was.
No, I think that tends to get exaggerated on, but in any case, I guess, you know, there are some other aspects of this that you and I might agree on more. Like for instance, in Florida, right, it's becoming because of climate change and at least a lot of people would argue climate change and natural disasters related to that, hurricanes and so forth. It's becoming incredibly difficult for many people to buy homeowners insurance in Florida. And for instance, I know Florida has a government organization, what's it called? Citizens Property, I think, set up to subsidize that. And I don't know, maybe I get your take on this, but my take is if you have areas that are so prone to.
Yeah, maybe we stop subsidizing places in the paths of hurricanes and on floodplains.
Exactly. This is, you know, I feel like, okay. I mean, DeSantis is supposed to be a super conservative government in a red state. And yet this, I mean, he doesn't talk a lot. But then again, there'd be like, I don't know, like a third of Florida that would revolt against that sort of thing. But yeah, that seems odd to me.
Yeah, no, yes, no. But no, because and again, these are places where, again, I'm skeptical because when we get the responses of this has been the most destructive hurricane season ever in terms of millions of dollars, billions of dollars. You say, well, of course, because we keep inflation. Every time there's a hurricane, we keep building nicer and nicer stuff.
Yeah.
Right there where the hurricane's going to hit. So, of course, it's going to be more expensive than it was last time. That's my skepticism. And also things about, you know, when the largest hurricane season, you know, I don't know. What was the hurricane season in the Caribbean Lake in 1450? Well, nobody knows, right? If you consider that, right, that we weren't always keeping track of all these things until really the last 150, 200 years, that changes. And our instruments to keep track of those things were not as exact then. The fact that definitions can change in terms of what's a hurricane, what's not a hurricane, what's, you know, when does an El Nino start? There was a story, this was recently, that the El Nino this year was like the earliest ever announced El Nino. But of course, when you decide to make an announcement about the El Nino isn't a scientific fact. That's a that's a human function.
Yeah, but I think
so. Those are my reasons for skepticism.
But I think
I'm not saying I'm denying, but
I think people, I'm sure of it, that a number of listeners that have gotten to this point might be thinking, well, okay, Jay, maybe you're right on all of those particulars, even if they concede that you're right on those particulars. They would argue that in a way it provides aid and comfort, it provides cover for people to take that bill of particulars and expand that into a reason for why we can just ignore all of the findings of climate science, because if they lied about that, they're probably lying about everything in the service of the liberal institutions that want to destroy our way of life and so forth. And so what you're actually doing is hastening our destruction by giving people good reason to ignore.
Very afternoon, hastening our destruction.
Hastening our destruction. There you go. So I'm sure you're
I certainly didn't mean to hasten anyone's destruction.
Well, you know, it happens sometimes.
But hastened. Look, I think if you are on the right, or as I am, I think it does make it difficult. I would say I'd argue it the other way. If you want buy-in from people on the right, then the answers, you know, then maybe the responses should you know, legitimate kind of questions should be like the kind of conversations we have, but they shouldn't be shut up, right? It shouldn't be the East Anglia situation, right?
Sure.
Where people, this is where it was raised the same issue of, well, you know, we adjusted all the historical temperatures because of we couldn't, you know, the instrumentation wasn't that bad and so forth. And, you know, someone said, okay, well, can we see the original numbers? And well, no, you can't. Well, why not? We destroyed them. What do you mean? You destroyed them? That doesn't sound terribly scientific. And the idea was, well, no, of course we destroyed them because otherwise people might misuse them and try to mislead people about the gravity of this this crisis. And that to me is reason to say, well, maybe I shouldn't believe you.
I think both sides are engaging, elements on both sides are engaging in what you might call, if we're going to make it sound all fancy, noble lies, right, to advance what they believe to be good causes.
That's exactly what it is.
But not that there's any political opportunism involved in any of this. Right?
No, I mean that in very much as you do. And if maybe listeners don't, the Platonic sense
of
noble lies that in Plato's Republic, Socrates, you know, makes the argument that, yeah, obviously there can be noble lies where because you people are also stupid, we have to lie to tell you something, to do something, because otherwise you'll do something, you'll drink the bleach or whatever. Hence the Fauci, well, you don't need a mask, but then you do. The noble lie being that they wanted to preserve the masks for healthcare people. You know, or that being at least the follow up or the to the noble lie. The same thing goes with the, you know, again, a lot of this COVID censorship type stuff of, well, we don't want to shit show with the Chinese, so we will not say this is a lab leak, and anyone who does is a wacko tinfoil head conspiracist. My position, as a conservative, is that we ought to reject the noble lie in favor of the idea that men are, by their nature, rational, and that's rationality is what gives us our basis for our self-government.
Yeah, I
Plato necessarily agree.
I hear you.
Plato's position, to be clear, was like, look, a whole bunch of you are just idiots.
Yeah. I'm with Plato, you know, not listeners, right? But, well, no, we've had this discussion before, is that you are a lot more convinced of the reasonableness and rationality of people on average than I am. I think most people are well-intentioned and want to do the right thing, but they're just, for various reasons, some of them just aren't too smart. Some of them, because of various factors, are just not able to to think, to reason at that level for reasons that are not their fault. People's abilities and all kinds of things vary, right? I mean, I can't dunk a basketball, yeah. You know? And so, but that doesn't mean I should be on the Cavs, right? I mean, so.
But I think the distinction, and I've been thinking about this a lot. Maybe one day you and I should just have a big discussion about this, because this is a fundamental piece here.
Yep.
I've also, you know, made that comparison too, that look, I can't play basketball like LeBron James. But I can play basketball. You know what I mean? I can still dribble a ball. I can still shoot. And it's sort of well enough to get by. Now, can I do that at the highest level? No. And I think that's what I would say. Look, some people are smarter than others. Some people have greater capacity for reason than others. But everybody's got sort of enough, you know, the sort of common sense reasoning ability, I think, to get through life and to participate in self-government.
Yeah, and that's where you're right. And we probably should find a way to structure a larger conversation on that, because I think I'm with the framers on this, and the Tocqueville and others from back then, thinking that, well, there certainly are a lot of people who are capable of it, but we need to set up our institutions and our processes in such a way to protect us from the significant portion of people who, for various reasons, aren't able to rise to that. And that's not, I'm not trying to degrade people or think they're in any way lesser than, but I just think abilities differ. And that I think you can make an argument that in making government more democratic, you can make it more harmful to the people you're trying to help.
Oh, no. I would tend to agree with you there, more democratic, but, I guess my argument would be, when the certain things, and again, we're getting pretty far afield.
We sure are, but it's, you know, what the hell, we're at the hour mark. We can do what we want at this point.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. But no, things like, you know, what should the government censor speech because, or people not be allowed to say things, or as Robert F. Kennedy, had proposed in the past, client deniers be put in jail. Because they may give aid and comfort to
no, I see what you're saying.
Who,
yeah.
That, who perpetuate the discretion of society. Well, maybe, but I guess is the question of, yeah, there are a lot of dumb people, but isn't the bigger problem, can we trust people who are smart?
Well, because
you can have people who are very smart, but also untrustworthy and unevil. And can we trust them all? Can we trust that all the lies will be noble ones?
But it's a balance. I think you'll agree with that. And that's the genius of the system, I think, that the framers initially set up, is it tried to strike that balance between those things. And I think you make a reasonable case that that balance has changed in a lot of ways, and not necessarily for the better. Now, it has in plenty of ways. But anyway, you're right. We are awfully far afield at this point. So, but yeah,
well, we haven't talked in a long time.
No, that's right. It's been quite a while. So, but anyway, maybe we should wrap it up. But before we do, I want to thank Kyle, who's a longtime supporter, been with us for, geez, I don't know, almost 4 years, I think, at this point, who recently increased his support for the show. So thank you very much, Kyle. We really do appreciate that. And if you're not already a supporter, or if you're a supporter but want to do what Kyle did and increase your support, we hope you'll consider that. You make it possible for us to do this. We are very, very, by and large, supporter. The occasional ads don't quite do it for us, so it really takes your help. And when you're a supporter, you get all kinds of good stuff. You get ad-free versions of everything we put out. You get our supporter exclusive midweek show, the whole thing, not just a preview, a bunch of other stuff. Check it out, patreon.com/politicsguys. On Venmo, we're at politicsguys. You can support us that way, or through PayPal. All the links in the show notes, as well as at politicsguys.com/support. And if you'd like to get that full midweek show, but you can't afford to support us right now, totally not a problem, send me an email on mike@politicsguys.com. I will get that set up for you. And whether you're a supporter or not, it really does help if you spread the word to other folks. Subscribe, rate, and review us on whatever podcast app you're listening on. Tell your friends, hire a skywriter, do whatever you can. It really matters a lot. If you want to get in touch with us, lots of ways to do that. There's our special Discord group for supporters, always a lot of fun. Email, mail@politicsguys.com, Facebook and Twitter. At one point, I'm sure we'll be on Threads as well. We'll see about that. Anyway. Before we go, as always, a very special thanks to our fantastic executive producers, Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, Andra Masker, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, Don Oglesby, and Ivan English. We'll be back with a new episode for you next week. We hope you'll join us.